In just a moment, keys to the Capitol. But first, there's an unusual adventure program waiting for you tomorrow evening. It's The Scarlet Pimpernel, a series based on the novel that captured the imaginations of people all over the world. An adult and exciting melodrama, The Scarlet Pimpernel is the best in radio listening for young and old alike. Hear it every Thursday evening. And by the way, don't forget that Thursday evening is also the time for the amusing and informative Senor Ben as he takes you south of the border for some wonderful Latin American rhythms. And now stay tuned for Keys to the Capitol on NBC.
What's going on in Washington?
We're going to try and save the pieces in Indochina.
Then will we attempt peaceful coexistence with the Reds?
There's more than one kind of power fight.
Congress's face is red.
Well, I don't think that you'll...
From Washington, NBC News brings you transcribed Keys to the Capitol, a weekly news program in which the National Broadcasting Company's top Washington reporters and commentators discuss with you the news of the week and what's behind it. Tonight you will hear Joseph C. Harsh, Richard Harkness, Leif Eade, and Arthur Barrio. NBC News has given these men the weekly assignment of going through Washington's official doors to learn the background of our national policies. And first, here's correspondent Joseph C. Harsh.
I think the real story of the reaction here in Washington to the events in Geneva, the settlement of the Indochina War, is best expressed by that old story of the people in the house waiting for that other shoe to drop upstairs. The other shoe has dropped. Indochina's gone. And while on Capitol Hill and wherever people have to speak for the public record and for the political record particularly, there is an immediate tendency to say, isn't this awful, and to look at only the gloomy side of the thing and, as it were, to go to the wailing wall. Nevertheless, when you get behind the scenes here in Washington and talk to the people who really work with policy, who work quietly in the background and have to figure out what we do next, there is, in fact, a sense of relief. Here we've been waiting for weeks for this other shoe to fall. Indochina was a horrible thing. We dreaded it, and certainly it isn't a desirable thing. It is nothing that anyone wanted to have happen, but at last it's happened, and the atmosphere is cleared, the air is clear, and now we can approach the task of what we do about it. The president set the course this morning, very clearly, when he started out his official statement by saying, I am glad that agreement has been reached at Geneva to stop the bloodshed in Indochina. Now, that is a sets a tone. We're glad that the war, that the shooting has ended. Of course, there are not many other things we're glad about, but it's happened anyway. The end has happened. The shooting is over. There's going to be a communist state from the southern frontier of China down to the 17th parallel in Vietnam. And this is bad. It's bad politically here at home. It doesn't do the Republicans any good to have the first change in the power frontiers of the world since they took office be a change in favor of the communists rather than a change in favor of us. During the campaign, they promised liberation and a rollback of the Iron Curtain, and now it's gone the other way. There's going to have to be some explaining done. Certainly the United States has lost a potential military position there, but there are other sides to this thing. And to my mind, the most healthy thing in Washington is that behind the scenes, instead of spending a great deal of time worrying about spilled milk, the tendency now is to think about what we can do next to keep this damage under control. It's a damage control operation. Now, of course, in the brief space of 24 hours since the shoe fell, nobody has been able to work out the entire damage control plan. But there is one first step in damage control, which comes out in the president's statement this morning. He says, we are requesting the agreement of the governments of Cambodia and Laos to our appointment of an ambassador or minister to be resident at their capitals. All right, that means that we are not going to just sit back at the wailing wall and say, all is lost, Indochina's gone, Southeast Asia's gone. On the contrary, we're going to do something about it. And the first step is to recognize the diplomatic existence of the states of Laos and Cambodia. We already have a diplomatic mission in Saigon, which is the new capital of what will be the new free state of Vietnam. And from there on, a lot of things are going to be done. Mr. Dulles, for example, has requested from Congress permission to use the appropriation for Southeast Asia in a flexible manner. And among the ideas that are being considered is the expenditure of those funds originally intended for carrying on the fight in northern Indochina to try and save what is left below the 17th parallel in Indochina. This is a great chance for us. Up to this time, we've been trying to save it with guns, and now here's a chance to see whether we can save something without guns. Are we going to admit that only with guns and bullets can the United States save anything from communism? Here's a wonderful chance for us to see if we can't beat the communists with weapons other than guns and bullets.
Well, Joe, don't you think it's a rather late date for us to be coming around to that point of view? Because the communists have been working that alley for a good many years over there.
All right, all right. Now it's high time for us to find out whether we haven't got something besides arms. And here in Washington, a lot of very intelligent people are determined to have a try at it and see if we can't beat the communists at their own game.
Well, don't you think, Joe, that experience has shown that we can't talk to these people, that we have to show more than merely a diplomatic approach?
I'm not talking about talking.
No, but I mean, well, you've got to talk to them to get along with them, the subtlest thing. You say we're going to salvage something or try to salvage something.
Salvage something below the 17th parallel where the communists are not in control. This settlement says the communists have control down to the 17th parallel. Below that, they don't have control.
That's right.
Now, are we going to sit back and let them take that over by default, or are we going to try and keep them held at the 17th parallel? We're going to try and hold them there, and we're going to try to do it by reviving things like Point 4.
Well, specifically, we'll have about, roughly $1 billion to spend in economic aid in that section, because we've been giving the French military and economic aid for the war to that tune. Of course, you mentioned guns there, Joe. Don't you think now that we'll see the State Department proceed rapidly with some kind of a Southeastern Asia Treaty Organization to back up and hold the line which was settled on in Geneva?
Yeah, you're going to have two lines, Dick, I think. You're going to have a military line which will run across the northern frontier of Malaya and along the border of Thailand.
Yes.
Thailand and Malaya will be where the military bases are. Now, between the military line and the political line of the 17th parallel is where we have a chance to see whether we can lick the communists by means other than guns and bullets. And it'll be a very interesting experiment.
Yes, and in countries that small, we should see some real results of your spending and technical aid missions,
too.
We
certainly should. And if we just get away from the wailing wall and stop whining about what we've lost and think about what we may be able to save, I think we can do a pretty good job there.
You don't think we need might, then, to back up our words?
Well, you certainly need might. Good gracious,
but
yes.
But I mean the world to take a more forceful approach than we have been. I mean, you've mentioned Point 4 and technical aid.
Well, might to hold the military line, which is vital. If the military line isn't held with might, then all of Southeast Asia does go, and then we're in the soup in the Far East. But here is a chance in front of our military frontier to see whether we can beat the communists in the area of propaganda, economic aid, good works, as it were.
Joe, do you think you can make that work without Nero on your side?
Well, I think Nero will be on our side more if we use instruments other than military than where we use only the military instruments. We were trying to save the northern part of Indochina with guns and bullets. Nero would have no part of it. But when we try to save what's left of Indochina with means other than guns and bullets, I think Nero will be all for it.
I was sitting here wondering if there isn't perhaps another and equally broad phase to this problem following Geneva, because it seems to me here in Washington we're hearing some semantics these days. For instance, we say that we accept the splitting up of Indochina by the French and the Reds. We also say that we'll abide by the ceasefire terms, but, and here's where some of the semantics come in, we refuse to guarantee the agreement. Now, it strikes me that what's at stake here is much more than just a game of Scrabble. What we are accepting, like it or not, and we don't like it, is the basic idea that we can live in peaceful coexistence with the Reds, at least in certain sections. This business of drawing a line across the country, saying to the communists, that's yours, this is ours, we're doing it on a somewhat global basis these days. The Democrats agreed with Russia at Yalta to divide Germany. The Republicans did the same at Panmunjom with the Chinese communists on Korea. And now we accept, there's that word again, the same kind of a deal with the Reds in Indochina, which was made in Geneva last night. Oh, of course, you can make an argument for such terms affecting Korea and Indochina. bloody and costly wars were stopped, dangers of still larger atomic wars were averted, but that doesn't get away from the principle that we've accepted in both cases there, and that is coexistence with the Reds. Now, that's why at Geneva, we made it plain that we're not guaranteeing the Indochinese truce line, that we will not fight to preserve the communist grab of the northern portion of Vietnam, which is just another way of saying that we will not guarantee to live in permanent peaceful coexistence with the Reds in such nations, but we do seem to accept the realities as of now.
Well, we've accepted the realities, Dick. Give us your opinion, will you, as to how this is going to work out?
I don't know how it will work out. I think you had a choice there of accepting the realities of these lines, or perhaps even going to a full atomic World War III. You have the alternative of accepting these agreements, or possibly even going to a preventive war. Joe,
yes. Yeah, it seems to me a lot of people who say coexistence is impossible overlook the fact that coexistence, although highly undesirable, is the alternative to a global atomic war. It isn't a question of whether we can just have coexistence or no coexistence. It's whether we have coexistence or atomic war with atomic bombs coming down on our own heads. And it's so easy to say you can't coexist with them, but it's not quite so easy to follow that through logically and say, all right, then let's declare war and let's start throwing these atomic bombs and having them come at it. But what strikes me is that there are really three choices. There is war at the one end of the scale, and there is an attempt at coexistence, which implies just trusting them to be good people at the other end of the scale.
Which, of course, we can't do.
Which is nonsense. And in between is the thing that Winston Churchill phrased when he said coexistence with vigilance. And it's there is, I think, the test. Whether we're capable of attempting coexistence with vigilance or must go to war. Because if we don't have our coexistence with vigilance, which means arms and strength, the arm might you were talking
yeah.
about.
But what do we do in that particular case? You talk about coexistence with vigilance. The Reds have shown, it seems to me, now maybe this is oversimplification, but in their actions in the Far East, do we say, supposing they start another bit of aggression, do we say, all right, you go this far and no farther, and then we continue this peaceful coexistence, and then perhaps 6 months, a year from now, you get more Red aggression, we draw another line, you go this far and no farther, continue this peaceful coexistence with vigilance? It seems to me that
well,
I don't like to be pessimistic about it, but
yeah.
We've got to eventually draw the line somewhere.
Red aggression is, let me go back to something that Dean Acheson once said. I realize that it isn't popular to quote Dean Acheson. This is a horrible thing. I know, I see you raising your arms in horror, Mr. Eve. But Dean Acheson once said that we ought to recognize that the communist world is like an elemental force of nature like a river. You can bridge it, you can channel it, you can direct it, but you can't reason with it. All right, people who say you can't coexist with them are really saying you can't reason with them, which is quite true. You cannot reason with them. You can't say to them, now be good boys and stop here and expect them to stop there. But what you can do is channel this thing. You can put up a barrier that represents strength. And if you have strength, they don't bother it. They've always stopped when they came up against real strength. I don't think the time is ever going to come when you can count on any of these communist countries to relax and behave at a line where they've agreed to stop. No, not for one second. But if we have all that the word vigilance implies, now you say, what happens the next time they aggress? What do? They're going to aggress whenever there's something that they can aggress easily into on their frontiers. I've heard them also likened to water that flows. Whenever you leave an undiked opening in front of them, they flow into it. But if you build around them barriers and dikes, they don't flow into it. That's what I think, to my mind, that's what successful coexistence means, that we are always on the alert, that we're always vigilant, that we have our armed strength, and that we deny to them any easy conquests.
Yes, well, but let's don't overlook here the communist technique of subversion and infiltration.
Because
we must beat them at that game.
A very important part of the Geneva Agreement is the setting up of elections in that part of the world in 1955. And now through their subversion and infiltration, I think the communists wouldn't have agreed to any elections over there unless they thought the odds were 10 to 1 that they were going to win them.
They wanted them right away. The French got it off for 2 years, put off for 2 years. And are we going to sit back and wail and say, oh, dear, at the end of 2 years, they're going to lick us in there? Why don't we use that 2 years to go in and put in something politically and economically strong enough so that they won't be able to subvert it?
I don't think we've got a unified voice on it, because it's only a couple of weeks since Admiral Carney, the CNO, was out there giving a terrific speech and said, well, we'll never be able to get along with those Russians and so forth. He said that coexistence wasn't possible. So it seems to me the first thing we've got to do is to get a unified voice here in Washington and an agreement on what should be done.
Yeah, when Admiral Carney said coexistence was not possible, he was a little bit out of line with his bosses.
Douglas and
Eisenhower have both said coexistence is
possible. But the Pentagon boys don't seem to take much stock in that some days.
What worries me here, basically, I quite agree with you, Joe, on the need and necessity and the opportunity for us to move into that section of the world now. But here again, we're using our economic aid, our 0.4 technical assistance, only as defensive weapons, where the Reds use their infiltration for aggression. Still, it's purely a stopping move.
Mr. Dulles promised to use these things offensively. He was going to do a lot of liberating before he came into office.
Well, speaking of power fights, this one is not on the scale of Indochina, and it's a purely domestic fight. But it is hot. It's hotter, I suppose, in some sections of the country than in others, and notably right now in the Senate of the United States. It's that old fight of public power versus private power. And it's held up the Senate passage of the Atomic Energy Modernization Bill for a week now. The president's right in the middle of it. It's his order to Atomic Energy to make a contract with a private power group that sent a massive political shock through practically every senator from the TVA area, and a lot of other senators, too. They're accusing him, these southern senators, and particularly Albert Gore of Tennessee, of moving in on TVA. The other day, Gore called this contract order a crooked deal, and he said if Harry Truman had ever proposed anything like that, it'd have blown the lid off the Capitol, and there'd have been an impeachment proceeding started right away. Well, the president has called TVA an example of creeping socialism, and he said that he wants time to study the whole problem of TVA, and I believe that's still his official attitude. But today he said that anybody who says that he's trying to destroy TVA is in error, to put it as mildly as possible. But he said this is a national question, not just a regional one, and that he's always willing to adopt a better course if somebody will show that better course to him. Now, this one's not about water power, it's about a steam-generating plant. And there's been a lot of argument for several years over whether TVA should be allowed to build steam-generating plants. It has some. As I say, this is a pretty hot political question, not only in the TVA area, but in other parts of the country, notably out in the Pacific Northwest, where the administration now seems to favor private power development over public, Hell's Canyon on the Snake River, for instance. So there seems to be some politics on both sides. This contract that the president has ordered is a rather peculiar one. The president ordered the Atomic Energy Commission, not TVA, to make a contract with a combine known as the Dixon-Yates Group. Now, this group would build a power plant at West Memphis, Arkansas, right on the fringe of the TVA area. The contract would call for the delivery of 600,000 kilowatts of power for 25 years to deliver that power to TVA in the Memphis, Tennessee area, to make up for the same amount of power that TVA is going to furnish the atomic plant at Paducah, Kentucky, and is furnishing. So it's a roundabout affair. Atomic Energy gets the power for Paducah from TVA, then is supposed to make a contract with a private group to furnish the same amount of power to TVA. And besides, as I understand it, the contract, the proposed one, would call for the government to pay all this private company's taxes, local, state, and federal. One side seems to be afraid that TVA and public power won't be allowed to expand. The other side, that public power has already expanded too much. What do you think about it, Dick?
Well, Leif, I am not a power expert. Let me make that clear and make it loud right at the start. But
what are you paying you for, anyway?
Well, I often wonder. I wish you wouldn't raise the point.
I was up at the governor's conference at Lake George last week. And certainly, all the Western governors, the governors from that TVA area, were just buzzing with this power problem and from a political standpoint. I thought it was rather significant that it just so happened that Secretary of Interior Douglas McKay, who used to be a governor, dropped by to renew old friendships and shake a few hands.
Coincidence, huh?
Just happened that he dropped by to spend his time with the governors and talk over this, well, I think particularly on his part, the Western power problems. I think it may be one of the deciding factors in the congressional campaign this fall, no doubt about it, in key states.
Has any reporter in this group or any other group, to your knowledge, been enterprising enough to try and find out who sold the president this idea of hooking private power onto TVA by way of AEC?
No, I don't know. I don't know whose idea that was.
It's a peculiar one. They never did explain it.
No, the thing
is, it was just a flat order.
As far as I know, our profession has been negligent in that no reporter has gone out and dug
that
one
up.
Yeah. We just don't know how it happened. I have a feeling myself that somebody sold the president a pup, that this is one that he probably is going to regret before he's through with it. But he's in an awful spot here. He's boxed in. On the one hand, he is pledged to restore private enterprise, and on the other hand, he says TVA is a historical fact. Well, if TVA is a historical fact and we accept the fact, then I should think you would not be using the Atomic Energy Commission as a vehicle for, in effect, giving over a section, a province of the TVA realm to its arch enemy, which is the private power group.
Well, it always raises a question, Joe, of why he didn't order Atomic Energy to make a contract directly with this company to furnish the power directly to the Paducah A plant. Why not do it that way instead of through TVA?
We were talking a moment ago about peaceful coexistence with Russia. I think we've got a peaceful coexistence problem right on our hands. Of course, back in the early days of PWA and WPA here in Washington, which I covered, we've gone far afield from the basic theory of these public power projects, as I recall them, as they were set up by the late President Roosevelt and by Secretary of Interior Ickes. That was that the government should go into areas with public power projects, which private utilities found unprofitable to build, and thus did not do it, depriving a great part of the country.
He was always talking about the river development, the eight big river development things.
That's right.
Well, leaving this subject for a second, gentlemen, there seems to be a conclusion among many, also along congressional lines, and this conclusion to be drawn from Congress, that is to give these congressional investigations enough rope and they're likely to hang themselves. You know, one can't argue the point that a good investigation can mean political capital. But at the same time, not to be forgotten is the reverse of this, that a bad investigation can be a political boomerang. And there have been examples of both, as you know. One example, during World War II, a senator named Harry S. Truman was virtually an unknown, except in the state of Missouri. Then Mr. Truman was named chairman of a war investigating committee. He surrounded himself with a good staff. His work group worked quietly, mostly in closed session. Dropped matters quickly if evidence seemed flimsy, but ran them right into the ground if there was basis for action. The results brought great Senate recognition to Mr. Truman. Brought his name before the Democratic Convention as the vice presidential candidate, and you know what happened after that. Then briefly, the opposite, the congressional investigation of Howard Hughes in the 80th Congress. And that one never got off the ground, except to provide a few laughs and some hot political copy. And it contributed greatly to the fact that today the state of Maine has a senator named Payne instead of Owen Brewster. But so it goes. Oh, true, we perhaps hear more about the bad ones than the good ones, but life is like that. The picture of Congress tripping over its own feet is not pretty, especially to politicians in election year. But Congress has no one to blame but itself. The recent lengthy McCarthy Army hearings did it no good. A second, concerning favoritism shown athletes in uniform, was a complete flop, with misidentification, the worst possible mistake in evidence. You might remember that Hank Bauer, the New York Yankees outfielder, was named as a favored son in the service. Well, it developed that Mr. Bauer was a twice-wounded veteran, Marine. The committee said it didn't mean Bauer, it meant Hank Sauer of the Chicago Cubs. Well, Mr. Sauer is also a veteran, so another apology was forthcoming. And I think that sort of thing is inexcusable. We have another flagrant example, that of the committee led by Republican Representative Reese of Tennessee. His group supposedly was to determine whether such tax-exempt foundations as Ford, Rockefeller, and Carnegie were operating according to Hoyle. Well, one could hardly call the Fords, the Rockefellers, or the Carnegies either subversive or un-American. Yet those were the descriptions recklessly applied to some activities of foundations financed by these families, descriptions thrown around by adverse witnesses. And this, you know, was the hearing in which one witness said he thought one of Pope Pius's encyclicals was communistically inclined.
Except that he didn't know that it was Pope Pius. He quoted until he was told afterwards. Then he changed his tune, as I recall.
Well, anyhow, we heard the smears, and before the foundations had a chance to defend themselves, the committee closed up shop. One committee member was accused of being an obstructionist. So went the explanation. Therefore, the hearing was dropped. He was an obstructionist because he refused to accept testimony without question, insisted on cross-examining witnesses, and proving there was no basis for such statements. Well, these hearings may be the exceptions, not the rules, but even a few are too many. Perhaps it's too much to ask such committees to admit their mistakes publicly. Perhaps this would upset the dignity of Congress. Or is it upset already?
Arthur, are you suggesting that Harry Truman is responsible for all the trouble Congress is having in its investigating activities these days because he parlayed an investigation into the White House and everybody else in Congress
There was no political motive behind any of these investigations.
I think that ought to be investigated, well, that remark well, itself.
Nevertheless, Harry did parlay an investigation into the White House, didn't he, for himself?
He certainly did.
Now, you think that these other boys have the idea that maybe they can do the same. This was a bad example to set Congress, then.
It really was.
I see.
Representative Javits is demanding that the Rules Committee investigate the Reese investigation now.
Yes, you're really getting down to politics when you investigate your investigation.
Now, if we investigate Representative Javits's motion in making that motion to the Senate rules, then we really get some investigation.
There is one point that I think we should emphasize, gentlemen, and that is that congressional investigations are an essential part of the operation of our government. That for every headline or bad investigation that we hear and read about, cover here in Washington, there are, let's say, four or five good investigations where a committee quietly goes about its business of investigating operations of a government agency looking toward legislation. I think a purely constructive investigation going on right now, and it's making big headlines, is the housing investigation. Now, that's bringing out a very bad situation, and nobody is charging it. Their witnesses have been misrepresented, that evidence has been phonied or photographs cropped, shall we say. And in this situation, I think also we should give Congress and some of the committees credit for doing a very good workmanlike and constructive job of investigation.
Right. Almost every hearing, say, for instance, on an appropriation bill, is in the nature of an investigation.
Right.
You get the administration men up there, and you force them to explain things, and you question them, and so forth.
What are you doing? What did you do with this money we voted last year? Sure, and we shouldn't overlook that fact.
No,
that for all these souped-up hearings, there's a lot of good, constructive work being done by Congress right on this investigating line.
Mm-hmm.
But there is just let me add to that list of old hearings that you mentioned, Art. One hearing that some younger people and myself never even heard of, and that was the arms investigation conducted by Gerald P. Nye's committee after World War II. Now there, I think, you have a very interesting example of a hearing which was founded on a misapprehension, which did considerable harm, I submit, and which, in effect, sort of took care of itself. Now, some people had got the hold of the idea that World War I was a dirty plot worked out by the arms manufacturers of the world.
You've been listening to Keys to the Capitol, brought to you transcribed by NBC News as a way of taking you behind the doors of official Washington with NBC's top reporters and commentators. Tonight you heard Joseph C. Harsh, Richard Harkness, Lee Feed, and Arthur Berrio. Keys to the Capitol will come to you at the same time next week. This is the NBC Radio Network.